Okay, well, thank you all, panel, for joining us. You will see from your packs the biography on each of them. I'm not going to embarrass our speakers by going through their biographies in detail. I'd like to say this is a stellar lineup of speakers on the theme of Wales's energy future, fossil or no fossil. So I'll start on the other side of the panel with Colin O'Byrne, who's general manager of Dragon LNG, which is one of the key players in the UK's energy infrastructure. Then we have Dr. Carol Bell, who, as you'll see from her pack, has a very rich background in the oil and gas sector in particular, and is now a member of the energy panel, the sector panel for the Welsh Government. And Jane Davidson, who I'm sure will be familiar to all of you, is the former Environment Minister in the Welsh Government and now Director of the Inspire Centre at University of Wales Trinity St David. And Alice Hooker-Stroud from the Centre of Alternative Technology, which, as you all know, has been one of the leading doers and thinkers on renewable energy for many decades from its wacky base in Mid Wales. So thank you all very much. We do can start off with Carol. Just reflecting on there's one slide that jumped out at me there, Richard's projections of where we need to be by 2050. And I guess there are two questions in my mind. Is it technologically feasible, and is it politically feasible? Two separate questions. But I wonder, in terms of the big debate about our dependency on fossil fuels and our future energy pathway, is it doable?
Well, I think there's one thing about the human race is that we're incredibly ingenious at coming up with solutions. But for my part, as an analyst of energy consumption, one thing that's left out of the debate quite often is population growth. And my view on population growth is that we have baked into the system, if you like, at least another few decades of very rapid population growth in certain parts of the world, which mean that the demands in those parts of the world for more energy will be increasing at a high rate. So that's one point that I'm not convinced that the projections of overall energy demand for the world are correct. And I think one thing that was touched on briefly in the presentation that we just heard is that we can talk about energy here in Wales, and we are very integrated into the English system, but increasingly, and we have other people on this panel who will be able to talk on this, we're tied into the global energy picture. And what happens globally is a very, very challenging question, in my opinion, in terms of energy growth. I remember when I was an equity analyst, probably now about 15 years ago, the then chairman of Shell, Sir Peter Holmes, said that once Chinese people moved away from bicycles onto scooters, because of the numbers involved, energy consumption would be off to the races. And how right he was. And I think the corollary to that is, once people get used to having access to energy, and they should have that access, it's very, very difficult to pull back from having the convenience of jumping on a scooter rather than a bicycle. So my question would be more, are we really getting the energy consumption patterns correct out into that far distant future? Because, in my opinion, population growth is very, very strong. And it's indeed strong in this country as well. It's much stronger than anticipated within the UK. And we're seeing that manifesting itself in all sorts of areas, like the call for primary school places, for example. So we're getting, you know, the anecdotal evidence of population growth on the overall figure. So the answer to getting to a low carbon future is, I think we can do it, but we're doing it against a background where population growth, far from levelling off, you know, there are over 7 billion of us on the planet, you know, there'll probably be 9 by the middle of the century. It's possibly a bigger challenge to be thinking about, but to get us from where we are now to that sustainable future, I think fossil fuels will have a part to play in that. And luckily, we have more gas in the world, which is the cleanest of these.
and you're pretty optimistic that technological innovation can get us there.
Well, if this planet was being run as an entity, you know, you would put a lot of your top brains into solving this question. That's not how we run ourselves. We run ourselves by nation states. I'm sorry if this sounds rather sort of philosophical now. So the fact that each nation state has a different policy and is at a different stage of developing its energy policy is not helpful in a debate that needs to be addressed urgently. But as I go back to the fact that technological problems that the human race has been faced with have been solved historically. But I think it's important for us to look at the right drivers, the right inputs, the right assumptions when tackling that, and not sort of parking questions that are, you know, of global significance that do reflect on the local picture.
Okay, I'm going to bring in Isaac Estrada, because you've been doing some work at CAT on mapping out what a zero carbon Britain looks like and how to get there. You know, what's your response to that, about rising demand and an acceptance that fossil fuels is going to play a part in our future come what may?
Well, I guess the first thing that I'd like to say is that, I mean, you say putting the top minds on this problem. There are actually a number of different reports that have looked at population growth across the world, looked at what a decent standard of living for that population might be and how much energy that requires, and compared it to estimates for renewable resources in the world, and there is enough energy. You know, this is a technically feasible problem. Globally and in the UK, the project that I work on, Zero Carbon Britain, has a very detailed energy study, an energy hour-by-hour model in which we model supply and demand. We can cater for demand in the UK, a reduced demand, granted, if we implement things like energy efficiency measures in the UK, we can cater for demand every hour using a 100% renewable system in the UK. It is not a technological problem. We have the solutions. We don't need to develop our technology further. The problem is a political one, and I think it is difficult. It's a big challenge for our politics, for our economies, for our society, for even our culture. And I think that's what we have to grapple with here. You know, we've got the technology in hand to solve climate change, to mitigate, to change our energy systems. We need to embrace the changes that are necessary to provide clean energy into the future. And that's our task as citizens and also as government, and also, you know, all of the roles that we play in our lives. So the challenge is political, but not technological.
Okay. Colin, if I can turn to you, Colin. I was struck by Rich's presentation in which he said that more gas-fired power stations have been commissioned in Wales than wind, but that we've been seduced a little by what he called lofty principles and setting overall direction, which has been, we've heard far more about renewables and sustainability and far less about fossil fuels and gas and oil. As somebody on the front line of this, do you think that energy mix will change in the foreseeable future?
I think the energy mix will change, but I don't think it's going to change as much as people think it's going to, and I don't think it's going to change anywhere near as much as we actually need it to change. In terms of getting to a decarbonised UK or decarbonised Wales by 2050, I think it can be done. I think the chances of it being done are close to zero. I think it's not necessarily a technological issue, although I think there are some technological barriers. I think the political will isn't there. I think there are significant cost issues, and I don't think the politicians have been in any way honest with any of us regarding the implications of moving to a totally decarbonized future. We have talked about, so far today, about energy production and energy emissions. And in fact, if you look at one of the sheets, it says that in Wales, our emissions have decreased by 20% against the 1990 baseline. What we haven't talked about is actually energy consumption. What we have done, we have outsourced or we have exported our production of carbon to China, India, and elsewhere. So as a nation, the UK, instead of producing 15% less carbon than it did in 1990, actually consumes 19% more. We've exported it. And if we actually want to get to a decarbonized future, we need to be honest and we need to tell people, this is not a free ride. There will be costs and there will be pain. I don't think any politicians will have sufficient honesty or the guts to be open with all of us. It's a global problem. It's not a Welsh problem. Wales accounts for less than 0.1% of the world's CO2. We could have a giant switch outside Wales and could switch it off, and it wouldn't make the slightest difference globally. Therefore, I think Wales, as Carol said, this is not a Welsh problem, this is a global problem, and when you get into global politics and global economics, I think the barriers are almost insurmountable. I think it's a tragedy. I think climate change is a real problem. I think it's probably the biggest problem we have faced in humanity, but I'm unfortunately rather despondent. Therefore, I think in 2050, to be quite honest, I think we will still be consuming a lot of fossil fuels. The fossil fuels aren't going to run out in 2050. We're not going to be forced to make a choice because of the lack of fossil fuels. And since the Rio summit in 1992, wherever we are today, CO2 emissions have increased every single year. We have had made no impact whatsoever globally. In fact, it's got significantly worse.
Well, lots there. Thank you very much. I'd like to turn to Jane Davison. There's been a fair bit of criticism of politicians, and it's easy, isn't it, to project our own internal hypocrisies onto politicians as a breed. But perhaps you can tell us about just the practical politics of this and how difficult it is for politicians as a class, if you like, to filter the expectations of people with what the science is telling us. And then also perhaps you can segue a little bit into the powers debate, because you were a member of the Silk Commission. And I thought it was striking also what Richard said, is that powers only matter depending on the pathway you choose. And for all the policy documents we've had, many of them you wrote from the Welsh government, and there's a disconnect between the action, and the planning bill seems to point to that again. What about continuing on our new pathway, even though our rhetoric tells us we're going to move to a new one? A lot there. do what you will with it.
And you're giving me about a minute 30 to do it in that side. Yes, and I think that what we've just seen in the presentation was a superb analysis of the challenges that face us all in terms of how we reach the outcome we want. And I just want to frame it back in the context of the fact that this is part of the Wales we want. And the Wales we want is looking at how we can create more sustainable futures for future generations. So in a sense, it's about keeping our children, our grandchildren, and their grandchildren in mind, as it were, as real human beings, not just an amorphous day like 2050 in the middle of the century, but what kind of world do we want future generations to live in? And I think it's also really appropriate that Richard started with a slide that did talk about climate change, because, you know, we do have the inexorable science, and as you've heard from other speakers, there might be a challenge as to whether or not we are going to meet the requirements that we would need to meet in the context of responding to those challenges, and that is a debate of its own. But we also still have to have a fundamental decision that we are going to try. And in a sense, that's part of the narrative that is missing at the moment. So when we talk about creating the narrative for what basis our energy decisions for the future should operate from, there has to be a fundamental understanding of the science that then contributes to a narrative. And then people can argue to the extent to which fossil fuels or nuclear or anything else that doesn't completely decarbonize can be transitional methodologies. But I think we're still a long way from that narrative. And I think we lost that narrative in many ways post-1992. The Kyoto Agreement, which is the only major regulatory agreement that was hammered out in 1992 between developed nations, did have that narrative and did lead us into decarbonising as a policy. Now, Kyoto, if my memory serves me right, finished in 2012, and I was at the climate change conference in Copenhagen, which disappointed huge numbers of people across the world because it was not able to deliver a global answer to Kyoto for the next generation of carbon emission reduction. Now, it's perfectly easy to say that in a country as small as Wales, which has a tiny contribution, as it were, to energy, although I say it has a contribution to energy above its population. Wales is the next net exporter. You know, why shouldn't a Wales or a Scotland or any other country in the world demonstrate a set of leadership about policy that actually puts pressures on others, particularly when there's a strong evidence base? And one of the issues, and I would absolutely say it's only one of the issues that was intractable in that context, was the issue around where powers lie. Now, interesting, when Richard put the slide up, he said, I apologise for the primary school presentation. And I thought, it's great, because it was a primary school presentation of the fact that the powers are anomalous, they lie differentially in different parts of the UK, not by design, but by accident. And that accident has opened a genie out of a box that cannot be put back in. So getting powers more coherent has to be one part of enabling policy to be more coherent. And just to give you a slightly increased understanding of the power problem in Wales, 50 megawatts on land, you heard. It's hardly national infrastructure in the context of an English project. Now 25 megawatts on land is being defined as a national infrastructure in the context of Wales, because Wales's powers are so small in the new planning number. 50 megawatts on land and 1 megawatt at sea? One. I mean, Chris Blake's here from Tidal Energy. When Tidal Energy first hit my desk in around 2008, we did not have enough powers in Wales to determine a 1.2 megawatt application. So we've got a ludicrous situation in Wales, whereby there is not the powers on land that are sufficient. There are completely different powers onshore, offshore. There is a relationship with the marine management organisation in terms of between 1 and 100 megawatts before it goes to UK government. In the context of offshore. So there are such a difficult base. And what the energy companies have said to us in my previous role in government and have said to the UK government all the way through is without a stable regulatory regime, they will not invest. And I think that that is an absolutely critical issue. So a policy led by the climate change imperative, which leads you straight into renewable territory, a policy that enables the powers not to get in the way. And what we found in the Silk Commission, with the recommendation about 350 megawatts, which we're fully confident, you know, fully conscious, in one sense was arbitrary, was the idea that if we're going to marry the environmental imperative and the economic opportunity as part of a response to a wider policy agenda, we thought that a really innovative opportunity like the tidal lagoon should be able to be determined in Wales. So arbitrarily, the Silk Commission, all commissioners, four independent, four representing different political parties, used the tidal lagoon as a threshold to say, at the very least, at this moment in time, Wales should be able to determine innovative opportunities that respond to that wider values agenda.
Okay, thank you. Each of the panel had a chance to at least make an opening remark. So I just want to see if there are any questions from the floor. Okay. Do we have a working microphone now? Okay, I apologise for this, but if you could speak as loudly as possibly could, and could you tell us who you are, where you're from?
Yes, yeah, hi, how do you do? My name's Neil Brown from Inner Arlington. I'd like to put the proposition that without a competitive energy price, there is no sustainable future for Wales and any other economy.
Okay.
That was going to be my very next remark.
Could you just repeat the question?
So the question is that without a competitive energy price, there is no sustainable future, if I'm paraphrasing you correctly. And that was actually something I wrote down as Jane was talking. And also I wanted to come back to it in the context of Richard's opening remarks. Because for me, when you're talking about policy drivers, it's imperative to consider economic competitiveness as a policy driver, because the energy price is an input into everything else that we do, and it's a massive capital input into social st- structures and cohesion within any society. So I think that's absolutely critical. And the example I would give you is the recent developments in Germany in terms of what they've done to the energy infrastructure in the wake of Fukushima. Now, Fukushima was a disaster that happened because of a geographical fact that caused, you know, an absolute catastrophe in a nuclear power situation. Germany's response was to cut back on nuclear power. What did they end up doing because of the way energy markets were behaving at the time? The answer is taking displaced coal, not gas, but coal into the system and putting far more carbon back into the system of electricity generation, which, you know, is a huge unintended consequence of making that initial response to the Fukushima situation. And the second point for Germany, which uses natural gas not only as an energy source, but also as a big feedstock into their chemicals industry, because of the advent of shale gas in North America, they're very uncompetitive now in that industry in Germany. And there have been times in the last 3 years when energy gas prices in Europe have been 4 or 5 times what they have been in America. Not 40 or 50% more, 4 or 5 times what they've been in America. So the economic competitiveness input, again, I keep talking about inputs into this debate, into a sustainable future is absolutely critical, because only by being economically competitive in a world sense can we guarantee that kind of future.
Okay, well, we've only got half an hour, and so I'd encourage the panel to jump in as the mood takes them. Try and keep the contributions as short as we can, as we can get as much to and for. And the same to the audience. Please feel free to jump up and to challenge. Are there any further points? I'm afraid the microphone, we have a problem for this session with the microphones. So we have three questions. If we can take them in a cluster, you serve the closest to me. Anything nice and loud and say you are, please.
Graham Ayling from Energy Saving Trust, and I'm just wondering if the panel can comment on the kind of trajectory of growth of renewable energy development in the UK, given that we passed 15% of electricity now, and apparently consented or in construction is enough for about 30% of electricity. Obviously a fantastic growth in a very short period of time. What's going to happen next?
Okay, gentleman behind?
Simon Powell from Arrow. It was just around the devolution question. History suggests for things like Scarwood, the Sands, offshore wind farm, the Welsh Assembly didn't make a particularly good job of trying to make decisions about nationally important infrastructure. I just question, you know, these larger projects and new powers, what processes are going to be in place to ensure that decisions are made swiftly.
Okay, further contributions? Calvin Jones at the back.
Yeah, I just wanted to point that, firstly, unfortunately, you can't magic gas from North America to Europe, so that 4 or 5 times difference is the reality of the transport cost, and something for refining cost of tight oil should you move it. The second point.
That's where human ingenuity will win out in the end. It will end up crossing the Atlantic. LNG, and we have a beautiful harbour and open haven.
The plants are being built even as we speak. The permits are being built.
Yeah.
It will happen. My own company is doing it, I know for a fact.
Yeah.
For the next 10 years, then you're gone again. I'm not going to remember, but when you talk about competitive price of energy, we are currently using our incredible surplus of energy across the world, particularly in the West, to watch EastEnders on 50-inch LCD screens. But we are not using the energy we have to invest sensibly and in a structured manner to move away from fossil fuels. So more cheap energy is just methanol oil, and we don't actually use that available energy to move to a more structured green system. So unless we can change the incentive set, there's no point coming to better price.
So I think that's an argument for short termism. And Calvin has written a very powerful piece on Click on Wheels this morning. I'll throw this back to the panel. We just quote one from Calvin's article. We'll hear from more from you later, so this is probably the last we hear from Calvin for a little bit. There was a line there which says, we don't have the budget, carbon, or cash to build renewables as quickly as we need, let alone the guts or the will. I think that times up a lot of the themes for our question. So we've heard before that I think the guts or the will is an interesting one, because Alice started off by saying that this is not a technological question, it's a political question. Colin said much the same in a very downbeat assessment of where we're at. You're both saying there are some technological solutions which can get us over bumps, but Calvin's counterpoint to that was that this is yet more short-termism, because if we're relying on shale gas in the US, that is a finite lifetime to that, isn't it?
Well, it's got a very, very long finite lifetime. I do spend some time in Houston, and I have to say the situation in North America is just so totally different to what it is here.
So tell us what the finite long lifetime is.
Well, it could be 30 to 50 years.
Okay, so 50 years is best case. Is it?
But this point about short-termism is crucial. And I do agree here with Calvin completely. Our main problem is that the lifetime of a Westminster Parliament is 5 years. My view is, and I've said this on a number of occasions, is that we should pull energy policy out of party politics. It should be out of it. It should be run by scientists and engineers and experts in the system that deal in fact-based policies and make recommendations to us as shareholders in UK plc.
I'm not sure the people of Paris would agree with that. So that's an easy thing to say. How do you manage genuine discontent? And we heard from Richard this morning, there is a room for stability here. People need to be brought along. You can't simply say,
right,
leave it to the scientists.
I think that's massively patronising on people. And it comes back to another point that I wanted to make, is that I think the energy industry has been particularly bad at being transparent about what it delivers and the input costs within that to the public. I think the public is totally capable of understanding the energy debate that goes on here, as long as it's not shrouded in all sorts of stealth taxes and other mechanisms for collecting government revenue. The people don't realise what they're actually paying for and what they have bought into in terms of the energy price.
Yeah,
Alice. So I guess my approach to this question of competitiveness and cost. I think we kind of have to ask a little bit what our economy is for. Is our economy actually here to make us richer for the sake of being richer? Or is our economy actually here to improve our society? If our economy works such that fossil fuels are cheaper or easier to invest in or will be burnt, rather than investment in renewables, and the ramifications of burning those fossil fuels are huge for our society and hugely negative, then we have to do something about our economy. Something is wrong with the economy. If that is the situation that is going to play out because of the way that our economy currently works, then we need to be looking at that. We need to be changing that. We can't change the physics. We can't change the fact that if we continue burning fossil fuels, we release greenhouse gases, we cause climate change, temperature increase, all of the other ramifications that go along with that. We can't change that physics. All we can do is change our politics and change our economics to fit with a world that is good for our society, that works, that allows us to live in this future. And this is another point that I just want to talk about. I think I'm not sure about pulling energy policy out of politics, because I think what we need to do is have more accountable governments. Right? We do actually have quite a sensible populace in many respects, I think. There is actually a lot of support for renewables. And when you have discussions that are very serious about what kind of future we actually want, so we have to be clear that if we continue burning fossil fuels, the future will not be like today. Many things will have changed by 2050, which will mean that actually we will not be able to continue behaving as we are. So the future will always be different, right? And we need to have that conversation. What kind of future do we want? And I think that actually people can make a very sensible decision about whether they want a future which perhaps choosing fossil fuels as an energy source now would lead to, or whether they would like a future in which we have chosen renewable technologies as our energy source, what kind of future that might lead to. And that's where this narrative comes in, and that's where actually people are really important. And we need to keep energy policy in politics, but we need to improve our politics and improve our economics.
Other than that, last point, I agree with you totally. I do not think we will be in the same position and that fossil fuels will be anything as like as important in the overall balance in 2050. But we
I'm
are
not just
where
talking
we
about
are,
that. I'm talking about the way that our society functions. I'm talking about the breakdown of infrastructure.
Without,
the gas pipeline's not working anymore.
No.
Your tarmac on your roads, not being able to carry your vehicles. You know, this is
I work on science in my archaeological research, and I do agree with you. This is absolutely critical, but it needs to be self-sustaining in a financial sense, in an economic sense, rather than making a decision that hampers this country and the United Kingdom in relation to other countries. So that's why I would want the biggest brains on the planet on this right now.
Yeah,
to be honest, to make that transition without losing societal cohesion.
I think that if we remember just back in our lifetimes, and I think we're of a similar age, when I first came into politics, energy was a utility run by government.
Yeah.
It wasn't the economic imperative that operates at the moment. It wasn't spending its life looking at prices for shareholders or anything else. It was a service utility, and that service utility has brought down governments when it's not delivered. So back in the early 1970s, the whole issue about whether or not people had access to energy was right at the top of the government agenda. Interestingly enough, it may well be that energy is at the top of the election agenda coming up in 2015. But even in that short period of time, and actually it is a short period of time, life has changed completely in terms of the way energy policy operates in the UK. But it hasn't changed completely in every country in the world. There are many countries in the world where they have maintained energy policy and delivery in the arms of government. And of course that can be, in the context of a liberalised energy market that we have here at the moment, the most liberalised energy market in the world, that might be seen as particularly bad news, and our behaviour adapts to the way that we have to respond to market conditions. But it can mean that those countries are able to change the way they deliver energy more quickly, and they can change their policy more quickly, because they are not in a situation where they might have to pay major compensation to external providers because of very long contracts. And of course, the proposed contract for Hinkley is 35 years. So we are talking about very long contracts that take us towards the middle of the century.
Can we just... Here's
the point about politics.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Can we just... Colin, if you come in, I have a question as well.
Yeah, I think Jane said they can change, but they won't change. Do you think for 1 minute that in China, which currently has plans to build 363 coal-fired power stations, they are going to care for one instant what Mrs. Jones in Waterstone Drive, if she likes her roof space or not? I am not clear about the role that Wales has in this. I think we've already established that whatever we do in terms of renewables in Wales will not make the slightest difference globally, and this is a global problem. In terms of setting leadership, I don't think the Chinese or the Indians care about what we do here in Wales. I don't think, you know, if we improve things here, I don't think they're going to make any change to what they do.
So what's your solution, Colin? That's a council of despair, isn't it? What's your solution?
Well, it is a council of despair. I think, I'm with Carol with this. I think the politicians have failed us on this, and I think they will fail us on this. For 20 years down, we have to decarbonize our entire society within 35 years. Transportation alone, you know, that's 100% reliant on oil and gas. We've got to replace every car, we've got to replace every ship, every plane, every train, we've got to replace diesel generators and factories. We'd have to replace everything globally within 35 years. It ain't going to happen unless something fundamental happens. And that fundamental thing is for politicians to be honest and say the way we're pricing carbon, the way we're pricing fossil fuels today is wrong. We need to price it at the long-term cost to society, and that means, folks, everybody in this audience, you are going to be worse off. It's not a happy story,
okay, so
but that's the honest situation.
Let's pick up where Jane was about to take us, which is how does politics cope with that?
And I think you gave a challenge to people coming to this summit today to read the evidence Science from Nick Pidgeon. And I don't know how many people have read it, but I just want to quote one of his key recommendations. Public acceptability may only be achieved if it's rooted in a significant way in a described value system. Publics are unlikely to settle for a form of change that does not show signs of commitment to the longer-term trajectories commensurate with these values. And I think that's an absolutely critical point. If the politicians don't set the value system, which is why I said what I did at the beginning about the idea that if this is going to be a response to climate change, where the Stern Commission and others delineated 2016 as an absolutely critical year in tipping over the effects on the planet. If politicians don't make a decision to actually ensure that all their policies lead towards a specific outcome, then in fact the public will not buy into it. And I think that's been part of the difficulty in the context of the debate in Powys or anywhere else. I mean, just as an aside, what we found through Silk was the people of Powys and the people of Wales, 70% of them wanted decisions about big wind farms taken in Wales. They didn't want them taken by Westminster because they wanted taken more locally where the effects would be seen more locally.
Okay, let me come back to you, Jim. Just on that point, and the point raised by the question is the record in Wales. We had, in your time, a values-based policy which tried to root this in a long-term vision which is based on the science, and the politicians have run a mile. That has collapsed. We have the UK-wide traction, the global traction since the recession has fallen through the floor. The politicians in Wales, despite committing to that long-term vision, 3% annual cuts, they simply haven't delivered. So how do you put those things together?
I think you put it together in the context of being prepared as politicians to be brave about what the science is telling us that we need to do. And politicians do need cover from others. And that's where the European Union is really important in this debate. Because if there is innovation through regulation, I mean, we're seeing it in the car industry big time at the moment in terms of more electric futures for cars. We're seeing it in a lot of the requirements that are being delivered. They're not just targets, they're legal requirements because of Britain's membership of the EU. So we can see larger groupings in the world make a significant difference to policy for the future. But it doesn't mean at an individual level that we don't want to, in the context of being citizens of Wales, believe that we should be doing our part as well, because otherwise we're always making it someone else's problem.
I don't think people actually care. Jane mentioned the narrative. I don't think globally, I don't think people care enough about this problem. The average temperature in a UK house in the 1970s was 13 degrees. The average temperature today is 18 degrees. If we really could, we'd be still back at 13 degrees and putting a jumper on. In America, people drive, they're still driving 5 and 6 litre engine cars. You know, people are consuming more and more and more. I think people don't care enough. And I think that's part of the fundamental problem. And they don't understand fully what the implications will be.
This is not going to be painless.
Hold on, we're going to move their fingers at the hands of the media. So if I'll take a clutch of questions and then I'll come back to the panel. So, Chris in the corner, would you just introduce yourself, please?
Chris Corcoran, naive member of the public, entering in an area that doesn't fully understand but kind of cares about. I think it's probably best way to describe me.
Glad enough to put down your badge.
There wasn't enough room. Can I just ask Colin, so just to be clear about your position, two cheeky little questions really. One, ideally, would we, in your opinion, not be using any fossil fuel right now? And two, just to clarify, are you saying that as a result of the fact of what your perception is about people not caring in the general situation, should we be doing everything we possibly can to go 100% renewable right now, or is it all pointless?
Okay, that's a good question. In terms of not using fossil fuels right now, when we didn't have fossil fuels, the world could support 1 billion people. It's as simple as that. The only reason we're up to 6, 7, getting on to 9, some of the estimates maybe even 11 billion people, is simply because of fossil fuels. If we switch it off today, within a matter of weeks, the world would be in a state of absolute calamity. There's no way we're going to get rid of fossil fuels right now. It needs to be phased out. And in infrastructure that was built over 170, 160 years needs to be phased out over a period of time. In terms of going 100% renewable right now, in order to achieve the 80% goal for 2050, we need to be growing the renewables at a rate of 20% per year in, year out. That's not happening globally. I think in terms of Wales, I think if we were to go renewable right now, I think the costs would be unbearable. I don't think it's just not going to happen, and I'm not even sure why it would make sense.
So there isn't any point.
I don't think it.
I mean, should we aspire to do it, even if it's futile, bearing in mind what is at stake and what is necessary?
It's not futile, but the costs would be absolutely horrendous.
But if we did,
if costs weren't in it.
I mean, in the bigger picture.
It needs to be phased, I think.
Have we got time to phase it, do you think, from the context of what you two are saying?
I think it's dubious.
I don't know, and I would put the world's best brains on it ASAP.
So if you're dubious, we're probably doomed, are we?
I think it's going to be a different world in 30 years' time than it is today, and I agree with Carol. I think this is the biggest problem as a planet we have ever faced. And I think it needs the very best people.
Thanks.
Thank you. Echoes of Dan's Army here today. I'll take a clutch, and if you could resist for answering until the end, I'd be very grateful. Could you introduce yourself, please, and speak as loud as you could?
Judith Markland. I used to know quite a lot about the environment 40 years ago, but I've moved away from it more recently. However, it seems to me that there are signs of a sea change. We have the New Climate Economy Group report saying this is affordable. We have the IMF saying this is affordable. We have the Americans, we have Obama using such powers as he has to the EPA to try to introduce restrictions on carbon. We have the Chinese actually trying to start to introduce restrictions because of the health effects of pollution. Does the panel agree that this is could be the beginnings of a sea change, and what should we do to cash in on it?
Okay. Gentlemen, first,
Derek Osborne, Chair of Konokumi. What I don't hear here is any response to the local demand that is coming up to make changes in the renewable direction from individuals and from communities. One speaker says that people don't care about it. I think people care a lot about it, and they're extremely frustrated that they're in a situation where everybody says, oh, this is too big for you, it has to be dealt with by big business and government somewhere miles away, and you can't do anything. And a lot of the most promising renewable schemes in this country, and particularly in Germany and Denmark, are ones where the local people have said, no, we are going to take control, we're going to shape our own destiny, and we may not make very much difference in our little place in comparison with China, but we're going to at least get ourselves in the right place, and gradually that movement will spread. Why are we not hearing anything about that from the panel?
Okay, see your hands. Nearest to Linda here, please, that's in London.
Lauren Norris, Cambridge University. If you compare our activity to that of China, is not there a point that a lot of our production is outsourced to China anyway? So we are displacing our carbon from Wales to another country. So if we continue to compare our morality with our neighbours, we'll end up doing nothing. And I think the point that it's really about is.
Okay, Gareth, come up at the back.
Just a very, very quick point on the clarification. There is precedence, of course, for a global agreement on environmental terms, which was the Montreal Protocol, which phased out CFCs in relation to a global threat. So I don't buy in this council of despair, particularly Colin and Carol.
I'm not in despair. I think if human race will do it. Okay, it's an existential threat.
Okay, I'm trying to get you all in, but time is challenging us.
Duncan Conley, Energy Saving Trust. The panel hasn't mentioned one word which I'm very concerned about. It's people. It's down to consumption. We need to engage people with their energy use. And until we can do that, we're not going to change the fundamental way that things happen. Because back to Colin's point, absolutely right. Unless we engage people in doing the right thing, reducing the use to start with, and if we change all the in Wales to the most efficient vehicle, not electric, diesel, we reduce transport costs or transport emissions by 92% overnight. So the technology is already there. We need need to engage people.
Okay. So, I'm sorry, I really do want to try and get my response. One or two at the most, more, please. Lady here's an hand there. Final hand, there was somebody back there, so Rupert.
Okay, well, a very good looking company called CVEC, is an energy RD company in Swansea. Certainly agree with Colin, the fact that this is an economic question, nothing else. But we use cheaper than fossil fuels, you'll see the switch. And the people have been mentioned by the council. And in fact, people don't actually care. All they're interested in is that there's electricity coming out of the plug, and it's cheap. That's what they're
Rupert, did you want to say something?
Rupert Bull from the GP Legal. We've talked a lot about legal policies, there's no narrative, people need to explain all of that science, but surely there was a solution that the government set, and that was behaviour change, both as consumers and businesses. And there is a policy, there was the CRC, the Carbon Reduction and Energy Business Scheme, that was launched UK wide. The Environment Agency was pushing behaviour change, consumers and businesses. Many years. The situation now that Bob J.T. Wales has become natural resources rather than has evolved, what are they doing about the energy change? Because that was identified as a solution to all of this.
Right, boy, there's a heck of a lot there, and we're not going to touch it all, and we have got a huge amount of time, and it's a chance for you to make a concluding remark. So you can all be grown up and decide which ones you want to answer. But if I can run through the panel, so...
Could I go on
your concluding remarks as well, please?
Yes, well, you haven't heard anything from me on energy saving today, but those of you who speak Welsh have probably heard me endlessly on the radio. And one of the things I talk about when the interviewer says to me, well, Caroline, what can we do with this high energy price? And what I say is, we all have to take responsibility for using less. And I'll give you a concrete example. I hate to go back to Fukushima the whole time, but in the wake of Fukushima, the authorities in Japan asked the Japanese people as a whole to do everything they can to use less, because that nuclear power that was shut down had to come in the form of oil and some gas. The energy consumption of Japan went down 6% and has stayed down. Now, that's the kind of number I feel, you know, somewhere in the 6 to 10%, that we as individual consumers, we wouldn't even notice it if we did everything that we can as individuals to save energy. Going back to what Jane was saying, you know, our lifetime is one where there's been immense change in energy consumption. I come from a small village in West Wales. When I was growing up, not everybody had a car. And certainly, if anybody went into Swansea from my village, that car would be full, okay? We just got used to this profligate use. That's something we can all take responsibility for. We don't need any government to tell us that.
I'm concerned that people won't do it. I mean, one of the questions there was about exporting carbon to China. That's my exact point. We need to stop doing that. There, are, you know, we need to, you know, as Carol said, we have a fundamental change in the way we consume energy. We need to look at carbon consumption and not carbon production. We're always focused on production. As I said, emissions are down 15-20%, but we're consuming 20% more. And to get to where we need to be, is going. We need to take some really radical steps, not just in Wales, not just in the UK, but globally. And we need to accept that there is going to be a cost to this. And that has a major impact on things like fuel poverty, because to be quite honest today, energy is relatively cheap in historic terms. When you can buy a litre of gasoline for the same price as a litre of fizzy drink, there is something fundamentally wrong in which way that is costing. And in terms of this being affordable, it can be affordable, but it is still going to be very, very expensive. China has said they're going to cap your emissions. They haven't said what that cap is going to be. The estimates reckon they're not going to reach that until 2030 at 50% higher than today's level. Therefore, I think overall, I mean, I do sound a bit despairing because I think this is a huge problem and I don't think we're anywhere near to addressing it. I think it can be addressed, but it's a global issue and I think Wales need to understand what its role is in that. And I, to be quite frank, I don't think setting leadership is enough. I don't think it's going to do it globally.
I think one of the critical elements in getting public buy-in to reduce consumption on behaviour change is actually being clear that either the government or the politicians on multiple party basis, not individual party basis, have identified a problem that needs to be solved. And I think Carol's example of the Japanese government makes the case absolutely for that. When the people of Japan knew they had to reduce energy because of Fukushima, they did it, and they could do it, and they have carried on doing it. Now, if we had an agreed position whereby the politicians of the day were prepared to say, we are going to be guided by the necessity of climate change, and after all, we have the Climate Change Act, so we do have actually a legal vehicle in terms of doing that, then all other aspects need to feed into that. That is a social justice agenda. Critical role for government in terms of how it intervenes with the poorest in that context. Absolutely critical role for energy efficiency in this, because the public hates waste if they feel that they are putting themselves out on the basis and the government is being profligate with its resources. And we have to get the right price for carbon in terms of the life cycle analysis so that it drives the behaviour of the generators. Now, that would all be part of a political vision. And in fact, it's really a call that when they get together in December for the next climate change conference, they are prepared to deliver on a better than second Kyoto, which includes China and America.
Alex.
Okay, a couple of really brief comments. One, we're talking about China versus Wales. I think we've agreed that this is ludicrous. But I would like to point out one thing, which is that actually historically, per capita, the UK has emitted the most greenhouse gases per capita over our entire history of fossil fuel use. On a per capita basis, China is still lower than the UK. Sorry, second highest, historically.
Second highest, if not third.
Second highest. I'm sorry, second highest, but certainly not behind China. Okay, so we have a moral responsibility to act on this. In terms of the affordability of renewables, I read an article in The Guardian this morning that if you change the economics, if you include all of the externalities, health, environment, etc., then actually renewables are way cheaper than fossil fuels. I think there perhaps is a change there, but we have to change our economics to suit the future that we want. In terms of fuel poverty, I see this as it's a political thing. We have a giant amount of inequality in the UK. You know, we're a really rich country, but it's concentrated in a very small number of people, some of whom are making lots of money out of fossil fuels, and this is kind of part of the power economy challenge that we're up against here. And actually, you know, there is enough. If we need the money, we can find it. We've proved that in the UK. We proved it with the development of the NHS after the Second World War. We've proved it with the economic crisis when we bailed out the banks. If we need to do something desperately, we can find the money. And if we work it right in terms of policy, we can mean that it is a more equal future for people, okay? So that people aren't in fuel poverty. We can help them insulate their homes. We can help them use less energy, which is a really critical point. I totally agree. We need to also talk about reducing our energy consumption, not just changing our production. My final point is really, I really want to rally against this people don't care point. People do care. We are talking not about necessarily about whether or not we prefer wind turbines and the way they look over, I don't know, fossil fuel power stations right next door to our house. This isn't really the conversation that we're having. The conversation that we're having is about what people care most about, which is their families and their community. Right? This is really, really important. And people do care. When you ask everyone across the world what is most important to them, it's their family, it's their relationship. Job comes about, I think, third, fourth, maybe fifth. And this is how we need to frame the debate, because this is, you know, these are, I don't personally have children currently, but I'm sure many of you do. These are your children's futures. This is what we're talking about. And we need to concentrate on that aspect. And people do care. And when we stop telling them that it's small and easy, that if people recycle a little bit and change their light bulbs and actually face up to the fact that it is a giant challenge, it is really hard. Not all of the things that we need to do are necessarily going to make you, you know, super ecstatic. It's going to be difficult. We need to face up to that challenge. But I think it's worth it when you see what's on the line, when you talk about it in terms of people's future and their children's futures. And people do care.
I know it all for me, but I just think one last challenge to you, Colin. If the tidal lagoon comes off, that world first will happen in Wales. So Wales can do really innovative potential things that could end up changing the renewable future.
I think it would be good. And when I said people don't care about delivery, people do care, but they don't care nearly enough, and not enough people care enough.
And
they're voting with their wallets, they're keeping the temperature up, they're buying Chinese goods, we're driving more and more, we have more cars, more televisions. They don't care enough to take the action that really
But we've not been honest with them.
That's my whole point. We're not being honest.
No, and I think we do need to face up to the fact that it is a really big challenge and we need to have open discussions. And I'm really enjoying the fact that this is promoting that. But they also need to be open in terms of the other options. So it's not just whether or not we want renewables, but what happens if we don't choose renewables and we need to have that conversation.
That was a terrific discussion. Thank you all very much. Thank the panel.